Hi, I'm Adam Leipzig. Good to be here.
Hey, how you doing, Adam? Can you tell us a little bit how you got into the film business and how your career started?
Yeah, I'd love to. Well, my career actually started in theater. I was the dramaturg and the producer at the Los Angeles Actors Theater, which then became the Los Angeles Theater Center. And we just did a whole bunch of plays and shows. After I'd been there for several years, I had done something like 300 plays, music events, dance concerts, etc. But what I discovered was that if we had a really, really successful show, it closed after 6 weeks and maybe 2,000 people saw it. And I just wanted to work on a larger canvas. At that point, even though I was in Los Angeles, I really didn't know anybody who was in the movie business except one person who was an agent. And I went to that person and I said, I'd love to work in movies or TV. And he looked at me, laughed at me, kicked me out of his office.
Nice.
That is never, ever going to happen. And I had the presence of mind as I was, as the door was about to hit me on the way out, to say, is there anyone else I can talk to? He gave me one name. And I went and saw that person. Same thing happened. Laughed at me, smirked at me, kicked me out of his office, but I had the same presence of mind. And that sort of taught me that you should always ask for one more person to talk to. So the way I got into the movie business was that I did that over and over again, 87 times, 87 of these. There's not a job. I'm not looking for a job. I just want to understand the business, the lay of the land, what you do, what's the vocabulary, what's the body English of the business. I did it 87 times in 90 days, which was no easy feat because these were in-person meetings and people would schedule, they would reschedule, they wouldn't answer their messages. I would drive back and forth from one side of the hill to the other. And when, you know, in Los Angeles, there's a mountain range that separates the city proper from the valley. So some of the studios like Warner's and Universal and Disney are on the valley side, and others like Paramount and Sony are on the city side. So I was going back and forth over the mountain range in my very cheap and almost ready to break down used car. And I was sort of eating ramen, kind of down to my last few bucks. But the 88th meeting was at Disney, and it turned out they had a job and they hired me.
Nice.
And if I hadn't done those 87 before, I wouldn't have gotten that job, because those 87 taught me what I needed to know, what people are looking for, how they talk, the kind of questions that you're going to be asked. And that's how I came into the business.
And do you think that's what makes you a successful producer, to kind of just keep moving forward even after failure after failure?
Yeah, I think what makes any producer successful is persistence. As a producer, basically, we have two jobs as a producer. The biggest job is to just keep going, to keep blowing on the embers even after the fire has gone out and everybody else has walked away and moved on to another fire. We just keep blowing on the embers. Keep them glowing. There have been movies that it's taken me 10 years to get made, and they've fallen out of option. People have gone away. Cast or directors who were attached said goodbye. But I just kept blowing on the embers. And that's really what successful producers do. They just keep it going, and you keep holding the energy of the vision when there's nothing there except your belief. It's kind of like squatting in a house where you don't own it, and you're not paying the rent. You just occupy the space of belief. And persistence, I think persistence more than talent, more than relationships, certainly more than luck, is what gives people the ability to be in this business. And really not just as producers, in any one of the 150 different professions in film or television or media.
And so you get a job at Disney, and kind of what are you doing there, and how does it go into your first film that you produce?
Yeah, so at Disney, So this is now rolling back a few decades. Disney at that point was not a successful company, believe it or not. Now it's the biggest, most successful studio in the world. But at that time, Disney had not even had a movie that had made $100 million and hadn't made an animated movie in years and hadn't made a Disney family movie in years. It was a kind of stagnated studio. So there was new management that came in. There were eight people in the creative group. I was number eight. I was the lowest person at the very lowest chair at the table. What was I doing? I was reading scripts and doing coverage and just providing support for the other executives. But there were not a lot of executives there. It was a really tiny team. We made, at that point, you know, when you have very little to lose, you can take some big risks and do some things. And those risks evolved into the studio that we know today. That was the time that there was The Little Mermaid. There was The Lion King. There was one of the very first movies that I did, which was called Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, which was the first Disney live action movie in a really long time. And it re-energized and reinvented the Disney live action breed. And one of the really good things about being inside a studio is that you see a lot of projects. There's a lot of deal flow. Even projects that you personally are not working on, you see other executives and other producers working on them. So you just get a lot of pattern recognition. You see every possible kind of deal, every possible kind of legal paperwork, every possible kind of complication and challenge that's going to arise. So it's like you're really going to graduate school and you're being presented with a bunch of case study problem sets, except they're real world and your life or your career kind of depend on them. So it's a little bit more challenging than graduate school, but you just get a lot of experience when you do that. And that was great for me. And that really prepared me for everything that I've done afterwards, because it gave me not only context, but a way of thinking about how do you work on a movie? How can you be collaborative? How can you, even if you have authority, not use the authority, not use the power, but be collaborative and gentle, really constructive with creative people in trying to create the ecosystem where the best work can happen.
Yeah.
Which is what I try to do every day.
No, that makes sense. And that's how do you go into your first kind of film that you do? Not on the studio level, but kind of more on the independent side.
Yeah. Okay. So after I'd been at Disney for a while, it had been, the company grew. It became a very successful studio. I had been promoted up and up and up. There were now three divisions. There were 130 or 140 people instead of eight. I didn't get to go to the set very much because now I was supervising people who supervise people who supervise people who make movies, which is not what I wanted to do. So I quit and I became a producer. And I walked into a company which had a distribution deal with Disney. And then I walked onto the set for the first time as a producer, retrospectively discovered all those things that I thought I knew when I was quote unquote supervising films at a studio. Were things that I didn't really know enough about because I hadn't been on the set, because I hadn't really encountered the day-to-day of what it takes to make a movie and the challenges, the compromises, the decisions you have to make on a minute-by-minute basis when you're actually there. So I restarted my education and just, did that. Because when you're the producer on the set, ultimately all roads come to you, all decisions come to you. And you take responsibility for them and you've got to make good choices.
And what kind of once you get on set, because I think the challenges are much different. What is some of the biggest challenges you had to overcome on set?
Well, every day when you're on a set, there's a plan and then there's a plan B and then there's a plan C. Like when I was making Titus, which was the first film that Julie Taymor directed and a film that I'm super proud of. We shot it in Italy, in Rome with Anthony Hopkins and Jessica Lange, Alan Cumming, Harry Lennox. Amazing cast based on Shakespeare's play Titus. So day one, we roll out to our location and it starts to rain and the trailers get stuck in the mud and we can't shoot anything. But this is an independent movie. So it's not like suddenly the studio is going to sweep in and say, well, you didn't get to shoot today. We're going to give you a bunch of extra days. That just doesn't happen. So at that point, we had to figure out what are we going to do and how do we save at least some of the day? And we found a way. We lost the entire morning. This is the first day of shooting. And so the first day of shooting is always fraught, Dustin, because it's the first day. And it kind of sets a tone for how the movie is going to go. So we figured out that we could move at lunch. So the whole morning was lost, but by lunch we had moved into a studio location. In that morning, while we were pulling the trailers out of the mud, our art department was prepping a set and we were actually able to shoot a scene, probably I think a scene and a half actually, on the first day. So the first day wasn't lost. First day was actually a triumph of ingenuity, meeting challenges, having people get ready very fast. You know, when that happens, the actors have to get ready for a scene they were not expecting to shoot. The costume department has to get ready for costumes that they didn't think were going to be needed for 4 days. So everybody leapt to attention, everybody pulled together, and we ended up having a good first day, kind of pulling success from the jaws of failure. So every day on the set is like that. There's always something that happens. It very rarely do you have a single day where everything goes perfectly. There's always something that goes awry and you have to solve a problem. That's one of the most exciting things that makes me so enthusiastic about this business. You're always solving a problem, and it's a different problem every day. And every show has a different problem because it's different story, different personalities, different locations, different kind of issues. So you're always solving problems, and you just have to get good at solving problems, which is often about relationships and how do you make relationships work and build a collaborative team so everyone has a clear vision of what you want that end product to be. Does that make sense?
That makes sense. So I don't know if you went to film school, but how do you feel about film school? And, you know, what would you give to advice to like a new filmmaker? Because to me, you were just the type of person that just, I'm going to go out and do it and get into the door.
Yeah, I kind of am that person. Okay, film school. I did not go to film school. Most of the people who work in film, TV, media did not go to film, TV, or media school. By most, I mean like probably 90 or 95%. Most of us did not do that. And so we can just say, based on that, you do not need to go to film or TV school or media school to get a job in this business or to work or have a career in this business. Let's talk about the 5%. I have great respect for what some of the schools do. And I have great respect for what the faculty do at the schools. And I run a company called Media U where we actually create classes that are sometimes go into these schools so people can have real practical training and mentoring from people who are currently in the business in the kind of practical skills that often are not able to be offered at these schools because they're not really designed to be four-year programs. It's about very specific skills that you can learn in months instead of years. So I respect the work that schools are doing, but they're absolutely not necessary. And I think depending on the profession that you are attracted to, you kind of need to make that decision yourself. Now, everybody needs training. Like, I'm still training. All of us are still learning and reskilling because it's a business where the markets are changing, the delivery systems are changing, the technologies are changing every day. So we have to keep learning how to do it. But school is not the only way that we learn how to do things. Sometimes we do it by doing it. And we do it by mentor-mentee relationships. And sometimes we just do it by getting thrown into the deep end of the pool and learning how to swim, which is, I think, how most of us did it.
I feel kind of the same way about film school. It's just like, you know, you can find everything you need to know pretty much online. And I think because the industry is kind of one of those industries where people feel like, you know, how do you get into it? I feel like they think only you can get into film school. You have to go through film school and then it works. And it's like, no, you just got to get on set and actually do your work.
Yeah. Can I just underline what you said, doing the work? So like, what do people really need to succeed and have a career in this business? There is 150 different professions in film, TV, and media. You know, everything from people who restore picture cars to people who do visual effects and post-production and marketing, distribution, and accounting and production management, and people who are baby wranglers. I mean, there's so many different professions in the business. How do you figure out what those are? Spend 10 minutes of your life looking at the end credit roll of a big studio movie as you watch 5,000 names go by and look at all those categories like, yes, one of those could be what I'm doing right now. How do I apply it into film or media? And from that point, it's about showing up and doing the work, which is something that if you show up, do the work, and do what you say you're going to do, you are already better than 99% of people in the world. Because I remember a minute ago, I told you there's two things that producers have to do. One of them is stay persistent and blow on the embers. The other thing that we as producers do is follow up with people. A lot of my job is follow up. People say, hey, it's Wednesday at 10:21, but you said I would have it by Tuesday at 5 p.m. It's not here yet. Where is it, please? If everybody did exactly what they said they were going to do by the time they said they were going to do it, I would get a lot of free time. But that just doesn't happen. So basically, a lot of being a producer is just, you know, you didn't answer my email. I left you four messages. What's going on? Did the actor read the script? Like, this is what we're just following up. And if people could do what they say they're going to do, when they say they're going to do it, you know, when we're working together in any collaborative way, That's great, because you're then putting yourself in a position to learn, to get mentored, and to have great experiences. You know, right now I'm producing a feature documentary. It will be my 38th film. We're producing it in the Galapagos Islands. It is it's the story of a sea lion, and I brought on Guillermo Navarro, who is the Academy Award-winning cinematographer, won the Academy Award for Pan's Labyrinth. He's just one of the great cinematographers who is working today. I brought on Guillermo to be like the cinematographer godfather for the amazing underwater and topside cinematographers that we have, to really set the visual language for the film and the technical visual language for how the images are captured and output. Now, you know, Guillermo knows more about cinematography in one hair on his head than I know in my whole body. He's a master of all of these things. And just to be able to hang out with Guillermo for a week in the Galapagos and hear his stories and hear the way he approaches things is so fabulously educational. That's what I mean. I keep learning. And I love learning from people who are just so expert at their craft in the areas where they do things well. You know, the thing we're doing with this movie, it's called Lions of the Sea. I think it's going to be so beautiful. 18 years ago, I was responsible for a film called March of the Penguins. And March of the Penguins really, it set up a new genre in documentary filmmaking. And that's, it's shocking to me, but yes, 18 years ago. I didn't have gray hair then, but I have gray hair now. And I think it's time for another movie that also is in that genre and probably advances the genre for this generation. It's been a generation since March of the Penguins. Here we're going to come back with Lions of the Sea. Better filmmaking techniques, different animal, better understanding of science and climate and the ecosystems that nature provides for animals and humans. So really excited about the film.
Nice. Definitely want to check that out. My other question was, if you had to produce a very small independent movie today, how would you go about distribution? Meaning, like, I see there's distribution's kind of changing in some aspects where it's almost like the music business. You can now distribute your movies where, you know, 10 years ago, you can't. Obviously, you can't get it on all platforms without a deal. But I see people, you know, I just talked to a very small director that, you know, he's making $300,000 or $400,000 per movie on Tubi alone.
Yeah. Tubi is actually, you know, Tubi is one of the good platforms, by the way. Tubi is a platform that I frequently recommend.
Would you spend money on advertising your, like, if you had to produce a small budget movie, would you advertise your movie through like social media ads? Would you just go straight to the studios? Would you try to go to a festival? Kind of, how would you do distribution today in a very small film?
Yeah, well, the first thing that I would do, even before figuring out distribution, is I would figure out my marketing. I would start marketing the movie before I started making the movie and while I was making it. By marketing, I mean I'd be doing social media and any other kind of tension getting activities that I could while the film was being made to try to aggregate an audience that is interested in this film and would be ready to meet it on the red carpet whenever it premieres, wherever it premieres, whether it's a Tubi or it's some big IMAX theater. And the reason I'd be working to aggregate that audience and to really own the audience is so I could be communicating with the audience and take them on the journey of making the film with us so they're excited and invested in it. And that will then really help me, that will help you as a filmmaker with distribution. Because if you have an audience that you've aggregated, you can then have a really good conversation with any distributor. What do distributors really care about? They care about selling tickets or selling streams or keeping subscribers. And as an independent filmmaker, you have to be able to prove to them that you can do that for them, that you can meet their needs. Their need is not another movie. They got 500 movies. That their need is keeping subscribers, selling streams, selling tickets. How do we do that? We do that by showing we have an audience. We have an audience that we are bringing to you that will keep your subscribers from going to another streaming platform or will help you sell tickets. And then you can really have a great discussion. And if distributors are not interested or your film doesn't meet their needs for whatever reason, you're prepared to go put it on a platform like Tubi and you've got your audience. And now you can be like the director that you were talking about who's making a couple hundred grand a movie just because they have an audience that they can sell to. There's an example from my recent films, which I prototyped this on. A few years ago, I did a documentary called A Plastic Ocean. It is about exactly what you think it's about, plastics in the oceans. And when I got involved in it, did I think that everybody really wanted to go see a documentary about plastic in the ocean? Or do they want to go see Barbie or Oppenheimer? I think most people want to go see a big studio movie and not a doc about plastic in the ocean where you know it's kind of not a good time. But we did exactly that. We really built our audience while we were making the movie. And when we put the trailer up on YouTube, within about a week, we got 1 million views on the trailer. And the next week, I sold it to Netflix because we proved that we had an audience. And that film, which was made with great collaborators and a lot of love and devotion and the support of several nonprofit organizations that were interested in social impact and policy change, that film has had an extraordinary life. It has changed the laws in more than 150 places around the world because that film became the primary advocacy tool for policymakers, government officials, some business leaders, changing the processes of their chemical plants, recycling it in the shipping industry, national laws in India and Australia, local laws in provinces and states. If you live in a place where there is any kind of limitation or ban on plastic bags or plastic straws or plastic anything, it is probably because the policymakers, legislators, regulators saw that film. And it was used as part of the advocacy campaign to make those adjustments in our lifestyle. But why did that happen? Because we aggregated an audience for the year that we were making the movie. And we were able to get it onto a very big platform, get a ton of eyeballs on it. And then it has the life that it has.
No, that makes perfect sense. And it's also great to have an impact telling a story, you know?
Yeah, when you're making documentaries like that, it is. But and really, when we make anything, we really want people to see it. Look, I've made movies where there's like you give a party and nobody shows up. It's very sad and very lonely. And you walk into the cinema and it's like, okay, there's me and one other person watching the movie. That sucks. And then, you know, happily, I've also been able to be part of the other side where theaters are full and people can't get tickets. But yeah, we're always here just to be there for the audience and to have that interaction with the audience.